The size of Alaska is difficult to comprehend for anyone living in the lower 48. It is huge, 1/5 the size of the entire continental U.S. When the kids and I moved to Juneau in January 2007, Todd and I worked more than 1,300 miles apart. To put that into perspective, it would have been closer for one of us to work in Houston and the other in Minneapolis. Adding to the challenge, you can't drive between Prudhoe Bay and our capital city, of course, even if you were up for a 4-day road trip. In fact, no one can drive to Juneau. You can fly or hop on a ferry, but not many people want to brave the frigid swells on the Inside Passage waterways in January during the legislative session. So Juneau's always been known as the most inaccessible state capital in America. I wanted to change that too. After the Palin-Parnell swearing-in ceremony and gas line meetings, my daughters and I boarded the state's single prisoner transport plane, available for the governor's use when the Department of Public Safety isn't using it. I was determined not to use the corporate jet that former Governor Murkowski had bought against everyone's wishes. About a 2-hour flight from Anchorage, Juneau sits at the base of Mount Juneau, enclosed by Auk Bay and hemmed in by dense forests. I think it's the nation's prettiest capital. We could look out the window and see mountain goats and soaring eagles and an occasional avalanche pouring snow down chutes carved in the mountains. One morning, Willow jumped out of bed in the governor's mansion to see a mama black bear and her 2 cubs waddling down the road right outside our door. She dragged her sisters and sleepover friends outside in their pajamas to take a look. Track was in Michigan during all this, traveling with a competitive hockey team, and he wouldn't return until almost time for his Wasilla High School graduation. We missed him terribly, but he was doing what he loved best that semester, playing some of the most competitive hockey for his age in the country. He missed the first family official photo at the mansion, so he's represented in the picture by a pair of hockey skates hanging from the fireplace over our shoulders. Todd couldn't be there for many of the mansion functions, so I always sat at the head of the table as official host, plus I often carried the conversation as the official hostess, too. That role traditionally fell to the First Lady, but I wore both hats as best I could and relied on Bristol to help with some of the finer details, such as choosing flowers, centerpieces, and name tag fonts. I loved it when Piper joined us at the table for important meetings. We moved in when she was in kindergarten, and she was always very polite when she slipped into a dining room full of dignitaries and asked if she could help pour coffee or serve cake or just sit on my lap. I wasn't about to shoo her away, especially during functions with partisan lawmakers who were gracious and kind over dinner, then pulled the typical political 180 the next morning with less than gracious comments in the press. Piper usually had important whispers to share with me at the dinner table about one of our puppies or what she needed for school the next day. She always kept me grounded and reminded me of what really mattered. As governor, I built my circle of close advisors carefully. The opportunity to pull in the perfect partners was challenging because few prospective candidates wanted to make the long commute to the state capital. So I shook things up a bit and made concessions more readily than other governors about where my staff's home base could be. New communication technologies allowed this. I wanted the right people for the job, and if Juneau's location was the main stumbling block, I wasn't going to mandate that families uproot and move to a beautiful but isolated panhandle, especially when the previous governors had spent so much time in Anchorage and traveling out of state. Early on, I announced a number of commissioners, including Walt Monaghan as the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I also announced other appointments, including my chief of staff, my legislative director, and my communications director, Megan Stapleton. They were a young, motivated staff with lots of energy. Some of the team had worked on my general election campaign. The new legislative director had lobbied for the chief of staff slot, but I knew he wasn't ready for that, so a hint of internal rivalry cropped up immediately. Meg Stapleton was well known from her years as a political reporter and news anchor at our local NBC affiliate. She had national political experience from her days on Capitol Hill with the Republican National Committee and her work for GOP power broker Fred Malik, as well as corporate experience with an Alaska-based telecommunications company. I also added my campaign manager and confidant, Chris Perry, as director of my Anchorage office, and she soon had everything running like a Swiss watch. During the vice presidential campaign, she would become the lone state staffer the McCain campaign allowed to accompany me on the trail. Politically, Juno always had a reputation for being a lot like Animal House. Drinking and bowling, drunken brawls, countless affairs, and garden variety lunchtime trysts. It's been known at times to be like a frat house, filled with freshmen away from their parents for the very first time. At other times, the capital city's underside was even darker. Clandestine political liaisons and secret meetings, unethical deeds, and downright illegal acts. When the legislative session begins, the good and decent people who live in Juneau can witness some of these extracurricular pursuits at places like the Red Dog Saloon and the Baranoff Hotel. Others around the state read about them in newspaper gossip columns. During the 2006 gubernatorial race, the FBI handcuffed a number of lawmakers. In short, it was a lot like Washington, D.C. With a state to run, a husband on the slope, and an active family to shepherd, I didn't have a lot of time to follow the shenanigans. And though some held it against me that I didn't spend time on the cocktail circuit, I was confident in my priorities. Meanwhile, there were many talented people who served in Juneau for the right reasons, and I enjoyed spending time with them, as their good work demonstrated their servants' hearts. I attributed part of the corruption problem, besides the obvious self-dealing motives of politicians, to Juneau's inaccessibility. Foreign tourists on cruise ships had better access to lawmakers in session than 80% of the citizens of the state had. That makes Juneau an island of sorts, isolating legislators and staff from the people who elected them. Until access improves, the political atmosphere there will not change much. And I know there are a handful of legislators who would prefer just that. Just as I took the helm, the results of an FBI investigation that had percolated between Juneau, Prudhoe Bay, and Washington, D.C. began bubbling to the surface. Bill Allen, the longtime CEO of Veeco Corporation, the powerful oil-filled services company, had for years held court in Juneau's Baranoff Hotel, where his firm maintained a suite. For decades, he was a big-time political fundraiser, and following the Exxon Valdez oil spill, his company was a prime oil services contractor. Like other business owners, Allen pressed for legislation that would benefit his company, but he pressed harder than most. Allen was friends with Governor Murkowski and his chief of staff, and with powerful Republican lawmakers. FBI undercover surveillance videos of the Veeco suite in room 604, which would become infamous, even showed the Veeco executive pressing cash into the palm of a Republican legislator. Months of videotaping and recorded phone calls earned Veeco executives a long visit with federal agents, during which they admitted having bribed several lawmakers to push through legislation favorable to the oil industry. Allen pleaded guilty to extortion, bribery, and conspiracy. His mea culpa led to other pleas, including one by Governor Murkowski's chief of staff, who eventually copped to a single count of conspiracy. All told, many lawmakers, staffers, and oil company executives would be found guilty of multiple charges, including wire fraud, bribery, conspiracy, and extortion. Alaskans said the Democrats weren't any better. They just hadn't been caught that go-around. But the reality was it was the Republicans this time. And some of them didn't like it when my administration rode in on the horse of ethics reform. At a press conference after my first State of the State address, we released a white paper on ethics co-authored by one Democrat and one Republican. As Meg and I left the conference room and walked back to my office, she commented on the anticipated favorable coverage in the media. "You reached across the aisle," Meg said. "I think Alaskans will appreciate that." But my legislative director wasn't so happy. He had fought the release of the ethics paper because he knew it would rub legislators the wrong way and would shut the revolving door between the administration and outside lobbying jobs. He was right. The moment the press conference was over, he delivered the unsurprising news that GOP lawmakers were furious and wanted a meeting in my office. Now. About a half dozen paraded in. They brought me a message. Don't come down here and expect to change things. Don't paint all of us with the broad brush of corruption. You go clean the administrative house, but don't touch ours. I reiterated the need for reform. They reiterated their vast experience and implied my equally vast naivete. Then we all smiled graciously as I noted that yes, we would be working hard to change the rules for the executive branch too. Later, one lawmaker called Meg to his office to continue the conversation. "I can tell you right now which bills will pass this session and which won't," he said. "It's based upon one thing, relationships, and who's sleeping with whom." Wow, shocking to hear it from the horse's mouth. But instead of being discouraged by that, we took it as a challenge and set out to prove that we'd live up to our promise of reform and positive change. Managing a $14 billion budget as the chief executive of the largest state in the union with thousands of employees is more complex than managing a city like Wasilla, certainly weightier than managing a household of seven. But lessons learned on the micro level still apply to the macro. Just as my family couldn't fund every item on our wish list, we had to live within our means as well as save for the future. I felt we needed to do that for the state. I had four core principles as a foundation of our budget: live within our means, expand resource development and industry, focus on core services, education, infrastructure, and public safety, and save for the future. As I reminded my staff, never forget you're spending other people's money. That should make us more prudent and serious than anything. Almost all of our state budget depends on development of Alaska's energy resources. The petroleum resource is non-renewable. When it's gone, it's gone. Not only is it finite, its value fluctuates. In 1999, the price of a barrel of oil was $9. In 2008, it was $140. Prices dependent upon so many factors: a war in a third world country, a hurricane off the coast, an angry petro-dictator, new oil discoveries in foreign lands. And our revenue department has to estimate every year what the price of a barrel of oil will be in order for us to build the budget. Alaskans know the pain of wildly fluctuating oil prices. We learned our lesson about saving for the future the hard way. During the heyday of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, we were living the good life. The price of oil was high and the boom was on, creating a gold rush of state revenue, which government spent as quickly as possible. We were still a vast, undeveloped frontier outpost in need of infrastructure, so the state spent fast. Then the smackdown. Oil bottomed out at $9 a barrel. There hadn't been much planning for the bust times. Alaskans began driving around with bumper stickers that read, "Dear God, give us another oil boom, and we promise not to piss it away this time." When that next boom came during my administration, we were determined to be conservative and accountable to future generations. As Thomas Paine said in 1776, "If there must be trouble, let it be in my day, that my children may have peace." Yet getting certain legislators, including Republicans, on board with budget cutting in a time of surplus was like turning off a free tap at the Red Dog. I was told more than once that I was crazy for not spending the money while it rolled in, because, as in every state, there were a lot of needs, especially for the children. At the time, both parties, nationally and locally, were spending uncontrollably. No wonder voters couldn't tell Republicans from Democrats. How can the GOP claim fiscal conservatism when we let our own party's congressional delegations fund things in the federal budget, like the new monument to honor the mules and pack animals in California? And Democrat politicians aren't any better, but at least their fiscal liberalism is expected. Take the New York senior senator's recent $1 million request for a museum to pay homage to the Woodstock Music Festival, widely criticized as a taxpayer-funded LSD flashback. My own fiscal restraint was considered by some Alaska lawmakers too sharp a contrast to the last Republican administration's lack thereof, and I was warned by lawmakers not to shake things up so much. Governor Murkowski was a nice man, but he had spent 22 years in D.C., where the budget does nothing but grow, so he was just doing what came naturally. Murkowski was so nice, in fact, that he unveiled his last capital budget while donning a Santa Claus hat. I don't mean figuratively. He put the hat on and signed a budget full of gifts for lawmakers. Not that he didn't trim here and there. He did cancel a senior care program for needy elders who had come to rely on it for their monthly income. Then he turned around and bought the jet. That darn jet. Both the public and the legislature had told Murkowski not to buy it. It was very expensive to operate, and pilots couldn't land it on gravel strips, making it practically useless for travel around a lot of Alaska. After I was elected, I listed the thing on eBay, and an agent finally sold it. I asked my own staff to develop efficiencies and gave them budget-cutting goals, and I didn't exempt the first family from this. We saved tens of thousands of dollars in our very first year just by discontinuing the perks like fancy meals, as I would go on to say in my VP nomination acceptance speech. My kids still hold that against me. When I was outside Juneau, I accepted the normal meal per diem of $60, but refused the per diem checks for the other six eligible first family members, including a $100 check made out to Piper. I handed it back and said, "Piper can't eat that much in a month," and we refused the housing per diem as well. I also stayed in our own house in Wasilla while working in the Anchorage office and while plumbing repairs kept us out of the mansion for months, rather than having the state put me up, as it had for previous governors, in an expensive hotel or a rented apartment. In fact, we slashed living expenses, and I drove myself to the Anchorage office and to most meetings and events. I was never paid to sleep in my own home, and I accepted only a meal per diem, despite what some critics would later accuse me of doing. This while Juneau's own legislators, including Senator Kim Elton, who lived right there in town, pocketed more than $20,000 in food and housing per diem payments in just 1 year. Meanwhile, I'm still trying to find a hotel in Anchorage that will put up a family of seven and feed five hungry kids for $60 a night. My budget priorities weren't all about slashing. We increased education funding and committed to putting $1 billion into where I wanted to go with forward funding education, so that local school districts could know how many state dollars they could count on every year. We also increased school services for children with special needs and beefed up funding for public safety officers to handle alcohol abuse and domestic violence in rural villages. But even with increased funding for public safety and infrastructure projects, by the time we had reprioritized the budget, I had made the largest veto totals in the state's history. It wasn't the easy path, but it was the right path. My team and I were determined to fundamentally change the game when it came to the natural gas pipeline. Instead of negotiating behind closed doors with a monopolistic industry, we wanted to get back to competitive free market principles ethically employed. To that end, we built a team of energy experts and lifelong Alaskans whose focus was on crafting a bill that would provide a framework within which any company could compete. This was a multi-billion dollar project, the largest private sector energy project in North American history. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, so we had to demand that the resource owners' needs be met. To get the project off the ground after decades of politicians just talking about it, we tried a newfangled approach, free market principles. We asked willing and able companies to compete for the right to build Alaska's gas line. Our approach would be open and transparent, with no behind-closed-door deals. The plan also included a series of mandates or must-haves, including specific timelines, provisions related to access and pipeline expansion, reasonable tariffs or transport rates so more energy could affordably flow through the natural gas pipeline, and better energy prices for Alaskans. Those provisions would allow local consumers to benefit appropriately from a pipeline running through their backyard. For instance, rather than pegging Alaskans' gas price to the price paid in Chicago, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act insisted that the project sponsor licensee essentially provide a pay-for-what-you-need transport rate, allowing Alaskans to pay transportation tolls relative to the distance the gas had been transported. Some accuse us of taking too hard a line with the oil companies. I knew we were acting appropriately to hold the company's feet to the fire. This project would cost the private sector a tremendous amount in government fees and prep work to get through local, state, and federal regulatory and environmental processes. So it made sense, along with the state's number of must-haves, for us to put some skin in the game by reimbursing the winning bidder for some of the upfront bureaucratic costs. Therefore, in crafting what would become the landmark Alaska Gasline Inducement Act, or AGIA, we promised to reimburse up to $500 million in matching funds for the exclusive Gasline license. Throughout the process, it was our goal to take one of the state's most historic and most technical, buzzworded, boring-to-read bills and boil it down to the common sense level, because that's my world. We had to articulate clearly and simply what we were doing so that Alaskans could trust us to do it right. While our Gasline team crunched away on the technical issues and lawyers, economists, scientists, consultants, and specialists from around the world provided drafts of potential language, the communications team, Marty, Bruce Anders, Meg, and I would cut to the chase like Ronald Reagan used to do and just talk to the people in plain language. The task was all-consuming, many hours a day for many months with office meetings, conference calls, cabinet meetings, town hall meetings, legislative discussions, emails, video messages, and media interviews. None of it felt like work, though. Instead, it was exciting and exhilarating because we felt we were making history. We knew we were headed in the right direction when the threats from some oil industry players began, everything from nasty emails to multi-million-dollar ad campaigns. Though none of the big three oil companies wanted to move away from their relationships with the previous administration, ExxonMobil seemed particularly hostile. As we got ready to present AGIA to the legislature, ExxonMobil's chairman, Rex Tillerson, we called him T-Rex, told journalists at an energy conference in Houston, "I don't really know where we are, and I don't think it looks like Alaska knows where it wants to go either." Still, big oil slamming us in the media was again confirmation that we were making the right decisions. Soon after, we introduced AGIA to the legislature. That new word, AGIA, quickly became part of the 49th state's vernacular. When I was labeled anti-business, it wasn't difficult to connect the dots back to big oil. The motive was clear. It would spend millions of dollars to paint us as bad for Alaska because it no longer had control of the state's decisions. The smear campaign was obvious to many, thank goodness. I attribute that to the fact that we conducted business out in the sunshine for everyone to see, and the people appreciated that. My administration's approval rating hit an all-time high. After much debate, the legislature adopted the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act, or AGIA. In the end, only one lawmaker voted against the measure. I loved every part of my job, but the toughest part was meeting with the families of fallen soldiers. As governor, I attended many military funerals, too many. Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell and I made sure that one or both of us made it to as many military events, services, deployments, and glorious homecomings as we could. We would cancel other scheduled events in order to attend. I attended deployments where I spoke to thousands of soldiers headed to the war zones. I spoke at their homecomings and noted with a heavy heart that there were fewer than we had said goodbye to a year earlier. I spoke at memorials and cried with Blue Star moms who had to endure the mournful call of taps, the 21-gun salute, and the final roll call. And I was nearly speechless with grief when I saw those moms change their Blue Stars for gold ones. As governor, I was commander-in-chief of the Alaska National Guard and was privileged to visit Alaska troops in Kuwait in 2007, stopping in Germany to visit wounded warriors at the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center. I traveled without staff because the U.S. State Department wanted me to travel with federal officials from the Pentagon instead of local officials. I saw our Alaskans sweltering in conditions that had the mercury soaring 150 degrees above the temperatures they'd left in some of their towns and villages. They were half a world away from their families, their beloved mountains and crisp air, the alpenglow in the evenings, and their hunting and fishing. Yet I never heard a complaint from any one of them. I had a couple of Alaska-style town hall meetings over there, and conducted reenlistments in the desert. And when a number of them decided to drive down the road into Iraq to conduct the ceremony, we did. Instead of complaining about the war or the hardships they faced, what our soldiers wanted to know was, how were the king salmon runs? And since it was almost moose season back home, they asked me, was there any way I could finagle our fish and game department into extending their hunting permits until they returned? I promised I would do that. Two summers later, I would head overseas again to visit our guard in Kosovo and spend another day visiting the wounded at Landstuhl. Amidst the peacekeeping mission we were undertaking in Kosovo, I was impressed with the troops' hospitality as they served me smoked salmon and a big Alaska flag cake that we shared under an Alaska Aces hockey jersey. Pictures of home decorated the entire base, the Big Dipper proudly displayed everywhere I looked. The spirit of the medical team at Landstuhl will change your life if you experience it. This talented medical staff, who could have been anywhere, chose to be there, tending our wounded warriors. USO volunteers are there too, selflessly giving their time and energy to lift the spirits of our soldiers. During my last visit, I met two soldiers whose legs had been blown off just a couple of days earlier. One had just been given the news by doctors the day before. And yet, when I had the privilege of shaking his hand, he only wanted to ask about his fellow soldiers down the hallway who had also taken the IED blast. Another young soldier, who reminded me of my son, was concerned that the surgeon would mess up the newly inked tattoos on his upper arms. "Watch my artwork, Doc," he told Landstuhl's staff before he was wheeled into surgery. One soldier was there on life support. Doctors were helping him hang on until his family could arrive from the United States so they could say goodbye. I love those men and women in uniform and all those who were supporting them with the mission. The troops were sacrificing so much. I obviously saw my own son in their eyes, but in addition, as I felt that sweet, healing spirit of selflessness in Landstuhl's medical staff, I saw the very best of America. In late September of 2007, I flew to New Orleans to keynote an oil and gas conference. I had noticed some peculiar yet familiar physical symptoms, like the smell of cigarettes making me feel more nauseated than usual. For a few weeks, I brushed these things aside, but by New Orleans, I had begun to suspect something else. There was no way I could buy a home pregnancy test in Alaska. The cashiers would know, the people in line would know, and the next thing I'd see would be a headline. The last time I'd tried, about 7 years before, one of the elite six had caught me at the grocery store trying to hide one in my cart. That was when I was mayor. As governor, I knew that my life was even more of an open book, and there were a few things that I thought were not for public consumption, at least not at first. Since nobody knew me in New Orleans, I asked my security guy to drop me off at Walgreens. Back at the hotel, before my speech, I followed the instructions on the pregnancy test box. Slowly, a pink image materialized on the stick. Holy jeez! Todd and I had always dreamed of a big family, and he especially dreamed of having another boy, bookends for his daughters. I quickly prayed about this surreal situation, first that I'd even be able to fathom it. I was happy that we'd finally have our starting five, but I could hear the critics now. She'll be distracted from state business. She won't be physically up to the job. That's what we get for electing the first woman governor. My administration was making great progress on issues important to the state. No one could deny that we were on a roll. I dreaded the reactions and comments from the Neanderthals who would think of this pregnancy as a distraction. I sighed and stared at the ceiling. These are really less than ideal circumstances. And for a split second, it hit me. I'm out of town. No one knows I'm pregnant. No one would ever have to know. It was a fleeting thought, a sudden understanding of why many women feel pressured to make the problem go away. Sad, I thought, that our society has elevated things like education and career above the gift of bringing new life into this world. Yes, the timing of this pregnancy wasn't ideal, but that wasn't the baby's fault. I knew, though, what goes through a woman's mind when she finds herself in a difficult situation. At that moment, I was thankful for Right to Life groups that affirm the value of the child, that say, yes, every child has value and a purpose and a destiny. My thoughts ran the gamut, from the fact that I was no spring chicken to the reality that now I wouldn't be looking at an empty nest for a long time. I remembered the Old Testament story of Isaac's parents. Yes, Lord, I thought, my name is Sarah, but my husband isn't Abraham. His name is Todd. Unlike the Sarah of old, though, I couldn't laugh with delight, not yet. I didn't want to tell Todd on the phone, so I concentrated instead on my role at the conference for the rest of the trip. I discussed with representatives of other oil and gas producing states what America's needs are and how we can become energy independent. I also assumed chairmanship of the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, where I could help influence Congress and the White House on energy and security issues. After my New Orleans speech, I headed home, but Miss Todd, who had gone straight from Canada, where he was visiting a workforce development program with my Commissioner of Labor, back to the slope. Between my job and his, we kept missing each other, so it was a few weeks before we were in the same room and I told him about the baby. He was ecstatic. For him, it's always been the more the merrier, and he especially wanted another boy. We kept our news to ourselves. We had always been private about our pregnancies. We didn't tell anyone about Piper until I was 5 months along. Our lives were an open book in virtually every other way, so for us, this was just a special, sacred time, the one thing it seemed that just we two could know and enjoy together. Later, I saw my doctor, Kathy Baldwin Johnson, at our Healthcare Commission conference, where I had appointed state officials and private professionals to discuss free market solutions to the state's healthcare problems. I addressed the group and then looked for Kathy, whom we called CBJ. She had been named Family Physician of the Year by the American Academy of Family Physicians in 2002, and she had also launched a facility for sexually abused children. She was admired by many around the country for her extraordinary skills and especially her compassion for patients. I had witnessed that firsthand. Between Willow and Piper, I had had a second miscarriage. But instead of treating our loss as if it were something to ignore, CBJ had been so kind, so caring, she even cried with me when she had to deliver the news that we'd lost the baby. After that loss, in my own heart, I'd also noticed a change. My first miscarriage had sent me into a valley of despair, but I'd made it through to the other side. Like everyone else, I coped differently with each episode of grief. I grieved when I had that second miscarriage, too, but with so many people now depending on me, I had to react differently. Life does toughen up your reactions to devastating news. At the health conference, I spotted CBJ and smiled at her when I slipped her a note on the way to the exit. I wrote, "I need to come see you." At about 12 weeks along, I visited CBJ at her Wasilla family practice. After the exam, we sat down together in her office, decorated with Alaska quilts, some of which she sews herself and gives to babies she delivers, like the Noah's Ark themed blanket she'd sewn for Piper years earlier. She looked at me kindly. "Well, you're 43, so there's a higher chance of certain abnormalities." Then she showed me some statistics, one of which said I had about a 1 in 80 chance of having a child with Down syndrome. "We discussed all this when you had Piper, and I remember you said abortion wasn't going to be an option, so I just want you to keep in mind that there is some chance everything isn't going to be as perfect or easy as your other pregnancies." I wasn't worried. I was healthy as a horse with four perfectly healthy children. Besides, my sister Heather already had a special needs son, Karcher, who had autism. He was our family's angel boy. In our family, we always said God knew what he was doing when he gave Heather, the most nurturing of the Heath sisters, the child with special needs. Among all of us, she was the one with the tender spirit who could not only handle, but even thrive with a child with challenges. And in fact, she had chosen working with children with special needs in public schools as her profession. CBJ said she'd like me to have a sonogram, so I walked into the office across the hall. The technician was a sweet, funny older lady who'd been doing the procedure for decades. She prepped me, and we joked about a lot of things while she pressed the wand across my belly. Then she got a little quieter. Suddenly, I flashed back to the grim sonogram I'd had when that first stoic doctor said, "There's nothing alive in there." Now my breath caught, waiting. Then the technician smiled. "I see boy parts. Would that be good?" Relief blew through me like the Matsu Valley wind. "Yes, that would be perfect. God is so good," I thought. "He knows what's best." She kept passing the transducer across my abdomen, more slowly now. It seemed to be taking a long time. "Oops, sorry, not sure on the boy parts after all. Your baby might be a girl." By then, she was taking so long that I didn't care whether it was a boy or a girl. "A healthy fourth daughter would be great. Yep, just fine. Please tell me all is fine." Then the technician said, the baby's neck is a little bit thicker than what we would normally see. My first thought was, 12 weeks along and you can already measure the baby's neck? Amazing! Then, a bit more somberly, I remembered that somewhere along the line, I had heard that that was a sign of Down syndrome. A whisper of fear tugged at my heart, but I brushed it away with a thought, God would never give me anything I can't handle, and I don't think I could handle that. God knew me. I was busy. Gotta go, go, go. I'd always yapped about how lucky I was that my kids were all healthy, overachievers, self-sufficient. Now I thought, I've got a tough job and other kids who need me. I just couldn't imagine how I could add a baby with special needs and make it all work. Unless he knows me better than I know myself, I thought a bit dismissively, God won't give me a special needs child. CBJ called me the next day. Combined with my age, she said, the sonogram pictures meant there was now a 1 in 12 chance the baby had Down syndrome. So I thought that still means about a 90% chance that everything's fine. There's a doctor in Anchorage I want you to go see, a geneticist, she said. I'm also offering you an amniocentesis, the common prenatal test for genetic abnormalities. I had always flippantly declined the amnios before, thinking they didn't matter since I confidently asserted I would never abort anyway. But this time I said yes. This time I wanted information. If there was something wrong, I wanted to be prepared. Todd was out of town on the day of the appointment, so I visited the geneticist alone, through a back door, under my maiden name. I felt a bit of fear. 3 days later, I was in my Anchorage office when CBJ called. I thought it was strange she would give me the results. I could have sworn that the nurse said she'd be calling. I still remember what time it was, 2:22 p.m. I have the amnio results, she said. I think you should come to my office in Wasilla. Can you come now? No, just give me the results over the phone, I said, indulging in a little self-denial. If I just stilled myself, I thought on some wishful level, if I just took the medicine straight, maybe God would reward my guts with good news. CBJ hesitated, then said, no, I really think you need to come out here. Kathy, I've got so much to do here today. It's okay. Whatever it is, it's fine. Just go ahead and tell me now. Okay, she said softly. This child will be born with Down syndrome. I'm coming to Wasilla, I interrupted and hung up the phone. I was shocked beyond words, shocked that this was happening. How could God have done this? Obviously, he knew Heather had a special needs child. Didn't he think that was enough challenge for one family? I drove the 45 minutes to Wasilla, gritting my teeth. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry. My stoicism in difficult times had always bugged and puzzled my friends and family. Bristol once asked, Mom, why don't you ever cry? The rest of us are watching some movie, crying our eyes out, and you're just sitting there. Shoot, my mom used to cry during the Mean Joe Green Coca-Cola commercials. Though I didn't tell Bristol this, I choke up all the time at the Star Spangled Banner, at any military event, seeing newborn babies, but secretly where no one can see. Maybe it was because I'd grown up hunting and fishing with the guys, throwing elbows on the basketball court. Even when my heart was breaking on the inside, I just never wanted to seem weak. Now, as I pressed the accelerator past the speed limit toward Wasilla, my eyes stayed dry and my mind raced. Maybe the test is wrong. Maybe my results are switched with somebody else. Maybe it's a mistake. God, are you listening? But when I got to CBJ's office, she showed me the pictures. There was an extra copy of chromosome 21. It's a boy, she said. A boy, you're sure? Thank you, God. For me, that was a glimmer of light, and I let it warm me as CBJ walked out of her office and returned with a book for expectant parents of babies with Down syndrome. I thanked her and laid it on my lap, unopened. I just wasn't ready. My sisters were the ones who could handle this, not me. Did I have enough love and compassion in me to do this? Don't you have to be wired a little differently to be gifted with the ability to raise a special needs child, a child who isn't perfect in the eyes of society? I didn't know if I should be ashamed of myself for even thinking these things. I read that almost 90% of Down syndrome babies are aborted, so wasn't that a message that this is not only a less than ideal circumstance, but that it is virtually impossible to deal with? Now, just a couple of hours into this new world, I could not get my arms or heart around it. That fleeting thought descended on me again, not a consideration so much as a sudden understanding of why people would grasp at a quick solution, a way to make the problem just go away. But again, I had to hold on to that seed of faith. Todd finally returned a few days later. He plopped down on the bed, still in his winter coat. I handed him the sonogram pictures, and that's when the dam broke. I could let my guard down. "It's a boy," I said between the tears. "It's definitely a boy." He looked up at me, and his eyes filled with tears. "See, Sarah, God knows what he's doing. This is great." I stood beside the bed. I didn't know how to say it any other way but straight. "The baby has Down syndrome." Todd didn't speak. I remember him lying back on the bed, holding the sonogram pictures and flipping through them. He'd look at one, put it in the back of the stack, look at the next, over and over, silently, as though looking for answers. Finally, I sat down next to him. In his subdued way, he did not offer a reaction, so I had to ask him, "Well, what do you think?" "How can they tell?" he asked quietly. "Are they sure?" "Yes, there's an extra chromosome." He set the pictures aside and turned his face toward mine. "I'm happy and I'm sad," he said. I thought it was pretty perfect the way he said that, because that's the way it was. That's the way I felt, too. Todd said, "It's going to be okay." I asked if he had the same question I had. "Why us?" He looked genuinely surprised by my question and responded calmly, "Why not us?" None who have always been free can understand the terrible, fascinating power of the hope of freedom to those who are not free. Pearl S. Buck wrote those words many years before the lean, proud, newly shorn young men standing before us were even born. The bleachers chilled their backsides as moms, wives, and girlfriends, and contemplative military dads, many teary-eyed, watch soldiers march in unison across a Fort Benning field in January 2008. As we watched rank upon rank march in front of us, it seemed true what they say about boot camp changing boys into men. I knew what Track and his friend Johnny had looked like when they left for basic training months before, and now all these young men looked tall and strong and serious, and they were headed into a mission that asked them to be ready to sacrifice all in a fight for freedom. Yet that freedom had never been absent for them. How did they know how imperative this was? We hadn't spotted Track yet, but if he looked anything like his fellow soldiers, I knew that my boy had become a man. I turned to Todd, who sat between my mom and me in the second tier. "Can you spot him?" Piper searched, shaded her eyes, then clapped her hands for all the soldiers. "He's right there," she said, pointing left. "He's right there," Todd said, pointing right. "No, that's him," I said. "I think, maybe not." "They all look alike," we all said in unison. "That's the point," some top brass character whispered over his shoulder. The boots on the ground at boot camp graduations on every base paint the picture of what is right in America. Left, right, one step at a time. It is straight ahead for those who, it can only be assumed, have a special quality that gives them a sense of honor and selfless duty. What else explains their choice, amidst so many other possibilities, to serve in the U.S. military? I recalled Senator John Kerry's comment to California college students in 2006. "You know, education, if you make the most of it, you study hard, you do your homework, and you make an effort to be smart, you can do well. And if you don't, you get stuck in Iraq." What a loon, I thought. What an elitist loon. Now I was in a position to know firsthand what I had always implicitly hoped. The kids enlisting are smart and observant and have made the most of the opportunities America has given them. So they choose to put other desires and ambitions aside for a while to protect our opportunities. I knew it because my son and his buddies were part of a culture that enjoys comfortable luxuries and choices. Boys who knew that once they graduated high school, the world was their oyster. And here they chose to make sacrifices and give up luxury and comfort. They have within them a willingness and drive to fight for freedom, the absence of which they do not even know. And that fascinates me. I thank God for the second greatest generation marching in front of us, because if not them, who? I was busy shuttling back and forth to Juneau with energy and education reform issues stacked on our administration's plate. Todd and I kept thinking, knowing that we had to tell Track, Bristol, Willow, and Piper about the baby, but I still didn't look pregnant, so I figured we still had time. Every once in a while, I'd drop hints for them. Sometimes life throws you a curveball, but how thankful we should be that life is never boring. Sometimes surprising challenges pop up, and then we see what we're made of as we make choices about how to react to the circumstances. I'd always journaled throughout my life, and now I also began writing a letter about the baby to our family and closest friends. In my research on Down syndrome, I learned that these special kids most often bring joy into their families' lives. While they had developmental challenges, they were also affectionate, generous, and cheerful. Rather than focus on what could be perceived as negative, I wanted our loved ones to focus on the fact that this baby, every baby, has purpose, and that not only would he learn from us, but we would learn from him. I decided to write the letter as though it were from Trigg's creator, the same creator in whom I had put my trust more than 30 years before. I hope that even though this new baby would present challenges, that we trust that God knew best, that he didn't make mistakes. I am blessing you with this surprise baby because I only want the best for you. I've heard your prayers that this baby will be happy and healthy, and I've answered them because I only want the best for you. I heard your heart when you hinted that another boy would fit best in the Palin family to round it out and complete the starting five lineup. Though another girl would be so nice, you didn't think you could ask for what you really wanted, but I knew, so I gave you a boy. Then I put the idea in your hearts that his name should be Trigg, because it's so fitting, with two Norse meanings, true and brave victory. Then finally, I let Trigg's mom and dad find out before he was born that this little boy will truly be a gift. They were told in early tests that Trigg may provide more challenges and more joy than what they ever may have imagined or ever asked for. At first, the news seemed unreal and sad and confusing. But I gave Trigg's mom and dad lots of time to think about it because they needed a lot of time to understand that everything will be okay. This new person in your life can help everyone put things in perspective and bind you together and get everyone focused on what really matters. The baby will expand your world and let you see and feel things you haven't experienced yet. He'll show you what true, brave victory really means, as those who love him will think less about self and focus less on what the world tells you is normal or perfect. Trigg will be his dad's little buddy, and he'll wear Carhartts while he learns to tinker in the garage. He'll love to be read to, he'll want to play goalie, and he'll steal his mom's heart, just like Track, Bristol, Willow, and Piper did. And Trigg will be the cuddly, innocent, mischievous, dependent little brother that his siblings have been waiting for. In fact, Trigg will, in some diagnostic ways, always be the mischievous, dependent little brother, because I created him a bit different than a lot of babies born into this world today. Every child is created special, with awesome purpose and amazing potential. Children are the most precious and promising ingredient in this mixed-up world you live in down there on Earth. Trigg is no different, except he has one extra chromosome. Doctors call it Down syndrome. And Down's kids have challenges, but can bring you much delight and more love than you can ever imagine. Trigg's mom and dad don't want people to focus on the baby's extra chromosome. They're humans, so they haven't known how to explain this to people who are so caring and are interested in this new little Alaskan. Some will think Trigg should not be allowed to be born because they fear a Down's child won't be considered perfect in your world. Many people will express sympathy, but you don't want or need that because Trigg will be a joy. You will have to trust me on this. I know it will take time to grasp this and come to accept that I only want the best for you, and I only give my best. Remember, though, my ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, my ways are higher than yours. I wrote that all down for you in the good book. Look it up. You claim that you believe me? Now it's time you live out that belief. Trigg can't wait to meet you. I'm giving you only the best. Love, Trigg's creator, your heavenly father. Writing that letter was the best and most loving way I could find to share our news with the people we loved. I had no idea that a year later, during the vice presidential campaign, a hostile journalist would use it to mock my family and the Christian faith, saying I was so self-absorbed that I even wrote a letter in the voice of God. In April of 2008, Todd and I checked into a hotel in Dallas. The following day, I was scheduled to keynote another oil and gas conference. My pregnancy was going fine, and with 5 weeks to go, I felt great. But at 4 a.m., a strange sensation low in my belly woke me, and I sat up straight in bed. It can't be, I thought. It's way too early. Moments later, I shook Todd awake. Something's going on. He sat up in bed, instantly alert. I'm calling CBJ. No, don't do that. It's only 1 a.m. in Alaska. I didn't want to call anyone yet. I just wanted to take stock and see whether this baby was really coming. I also wanted time to pray and ask God silently but fervently to let everything be okay. Desperation for this baby overwhelmed me. Please don't let anything happen to this baby. It occurred to me, once and for all, I am so in love with this child. Please, God, protect him. After all my doubts and fears, I had fallen in love with this precious child. The worst thing in the world would be that I would lose him. God knew what he was doing. Over my protests, Todd called CBJ. I told her that I felt fine and absolutely did not want to cancel my speech and disappoint the folks at the conference, including my co-host, Texas Governor Rick Perry. We agreed that I would stay in contact with CBJ through the day. I'd take it easy, give my speech, then catch an earlier flight back to Alaska. I still had plenty of time. Later that afternoon, we entered a packed house at the energy conference where I'd speak on the urgent need to tap conventional supplies and innovate on stabilizing renewable sources. I was anxious to tell them how Alaska could lead on a needed national energy plan. Governor Perry introduced me with some humorous remarks about things we had in common, like loving the outdoors, and something about how we love people who cling to their guns and religion, and how we face down the good old boys. Then I took the podium and opened by teasing the audience about how great it was to be in our little sister state of Texas. Big laughs, more contractions. Then I introduced everybody to Todd, Alaska's first dude, who, instead of sitting at the head table, was standing at the back of the hall giving me the get on with it, let's keep it short this time look, and practically holding the door open for our quick exit to the airport. I told the gathered industry officials that Alaska was suspending its fuel tax, giving relief to consumers at the pump, and outlined our three-legged stool approach to meeting our energy needs: conservation, responsible development, and renewable energy sources. Thus, we set a goal of drawing 50% of our electricity generation from renewable sources, an unprecedented policy goal in the United States. We would also use the earnings from a multi-million-dollar renewable energy fund for projects like hydropower, along with wind, geothermal, and biomass. Those projects could not even flirt with snake oil science, I insisted. They must be doable, economical, and real. Finally, Alaska would lead America toward energy security and a cleaner, safer world through responsible development of our conventional sources as we built our AGEA gas line. And I reminded Texas that there is an inherent link between energy and security, energy and prosperity, energy and peace. The audience graciously gave me a standing ovation. Then I handed the mic back to Rick and walked off the stage. Hey, Rick drawled over the sound system with a chuckle, we're not finished with the program. I turned around, smiled, waved, and kept moving. I know you're pregnant, Rick said, joking into the mic, but don't tell me you're going off to have the baby right now. The audience laughed. I smiled and waved goodbye. I thought, if you only knew. Many hours and two plane flights later, with Todd and our daughters nearby, I delivered Trig Paxson Van Palen into the world at Matsu Regional Medical Center. When the nurse placed him in my arms, I was overwhelmed with love and with wonder. I knew God had answered my prayer so completely. He just nestled softly into me as if to say, "Ah, I'm here, Mom." I was glad God brought him to us early. We were so anxious to meet him. I hadn't known what to expect. I didn't know what he would look like or how I would feel. But when I saw him, my heart was flooded with unspeakable joy. I knew that not only had God made Trig different, but he had made him perfect. The girls gently cooed and cuddled and quietly helped swaddle their new baby brother. Todd beamed. I heard him whisper to CBJ, he doesn't look Downs. CBJ looked up at Todd and gave him a kind, knowing smile. When I look at my beautiful son today, I know what her smile meant. She sees it in the eyes of other parents who have a child that perhaps our world doesn't consider precious or prized. I see photos of Trig and can recognize the physical traits that let all Down children look like brothers and sisters, the characteristics that may puzzle some who, just like me a few months prior, don't yet understand. But looking at these children in real life, we see only perfection. Go to hell, but resign first. The message was pithy and concise, and it reflected the sentiments of some in the oil industry toward me and my team. But this particularly crisp instruction was sent to DNR Commissioner Tom Irwin by a North Slope Oil Services Company employee. Tom Irwin, my oil and gas expert's recent actions had prompted the email. For the 22nd time, ExxonMobil had submitted its plan to begin drilling in the Point Thompson unit, but still had not drilled. These domestic supplies of energy were needed. So with my full support, Tom played hardball and took steps to prove that ExxonMobil was in default of its lease agreements. My administration announced that for the state's and country's sake, ExxonMobil would no longer be allowed to just warehouse America's resources. After all these decades, if the largest company in the world wasn't going to abide by its contracts to drill, we would rebid the leases and find a company that would. That resulted in the kind note to Tom from an industry player about his employment future and eternal destination. Adjacent to the much-discussed Arctic National Wildlife Refuge area, Point Thompson is a North Slope parcel of state-owned land that holds trillions of cubic feet of clean natural gas and an equally enormous amount of oil. The leases in question were the subject of a prior expansion that would substantially enlarge the area in which ExxonMobil was permitted to drill. Of course, the big question was, why would DNR approve an expansion when ExxonMobil had sat on the unit for more than 25 years and had never successfully sunk a drill bit? The Murkowski administration had even recognized the injustice of the situation and had begun taking steps to force ExxonMobil to drill or relinquish its leases. ExxonMobil had recently been fined $20 million for not drilling. The company paid the fine. To them, it was a drop in the bucket. When my administration moved to Juneau, we agreed with the Murkowski team's opinion and told ExxonMobil its leases would be history unless we saw action. The oil giant's MO is to tie up issues through litigation. It threatened to sue. We said, okay, we know the way to the courthouse too. When you deal with oil executives, you have to remember that they are used to winning. They also spend a lot of time in foreign countries dealing with leaders who carry pistols and whose bodyguards carry AK-47s. Meanwhile, the executives themselves are armed with bottomless bank accounts and highly trained platoons of fire-breathing lawyers, thus reminding our friends in big oil that they have a contract that they're obligated to fulfill was really not going to scare them. A $20 million fine? Pocket change. But with their leases on the line permanently, the question ExxonMobil executives finally had to ask themselves was, do we really want to give up prime parcels that are loaded with billions of dollars worth of natural resources that the public and our shareholders want us to develop? As Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission chair, when I wasn't butting heads with the state GOP, I was getting a thorough education in issues surrounding oil and gas recovery and production. I also learned that in the energy industry, you have to send messages independently to each group. To explorers, you speak of expansion and access to get their new discoveries to market. To producers, you speak of inducements such as stable investment climate. To pipeline owners, you speak of open seasons and shipping and tariff rates that let them recover costs. Most important, to the resource owners, in this case, the people of Alaska, you speak of getting the oil safely out of the ground into our cars and homes and businesses to provide economic and security benefits. 2 days after my first State of the State address, I spoke to a group of energy explorers at an industry breakfast. It provided me with the perfect opportunity to set that stage and let our most powerful industry know how I would lead. Among the messages that I wished to send, Alaska is now open for business. I said, you and the industry make your living by providing the goods and services necessary to get Alaska's resources to market. You live by contracts and legal obligations. Leases and unit agreements are contracts. Lessees must develop the public's resources or give back their leases. ExxonMobil needed to develop now or let others compete to do so. In the larger scheme of things, I also knew that unless we accessed our known reserves on state lands, it would be much more difficult to argue for access to federal lands, such as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We had to prove we could do so safely and ethically before the feds would let us develop in more controversial areas. It all dovetailed together. As a state chief executive sitting across the table from well-heeled, lawyered-up oil executives, it was a given. You have to be committed to the position that is right for the people who hired you. You can't blink, and we didn't. Once we put our foot down, we won ruling after ruling after ruling. May 1st, 2007, Superior Court Judge Sharon Gleason denied a motion filed by producers in the former Point Thompson unit to stay their appeal of our lease termination. May 22nd, 2007, Judge Gleason refused the producers' motion to separate issues on appeal and also denied their request that the court not give deference to DNR's expertise. December 26, 2007, DNR was found to have acted properly when it rejected ExxonMobil's plan. When you know you've made the right call, you stand your ground. DNR had made the right call. We would now see development. Victory! 2 years into our term, Rolagons, packed with drilling equipment, started driving up the long ice road to Point Thompson to deploy hundreds of new workers in their hard hats and steel-toed boots. Exxon began ordering parts and supplies and buying equipment in order to develop rich reserves for the industry, the state, and the nation. This was a bipartisan victory that created the mutually beneficial relationship between government and industry we had sought all along.